The Standard Deviations podcast is a weekly production that looks at money, mind, and meaning, all through a psychological lens. Each week, psychologist and New York Times bestselling author Dr. Daniel Crosby interviews a fascinating new guest, experts in everything from finance to literature to wellness. Support for Standard Deviations and the following message comes from The Guardian Network, a national community of preferred financial representatives and agencies dedicated to helping Americans live with greater financial confidence through a collaborative planning approach. Have you thought about what the cash for that Insta-worthy burger or latte you ordered out this week might buy you tomorrow? The Guardian Network created this cool, useful digital experience that can help you to see how your spending today lines up with your priorities. Play the cash stash dash at livingconfidently.com/cash-.
Jeff Zentner, welcome to the show, man.
Hey, thanks, Daniel. I appreciate it. Good to be here.
Yeah. So Jeff Zentner here, he is one of the smartest and most talented people I know. He is B, the William C. Morris award-winning author of The Serpent King. His second book was called Goodbye Days, and he has a third book out. When is it, Jeff?
February 26th, 2019.
Yeah, and the name of that was what again?
Rain and Delilah's Midnight Matinee.
Yes. So a multi-award-winning author. He actually has so many awards that he just accidentally bumped one off the shelf when we were getting ready for this podcast. So that's how decorated this man is. So thank you for being here. So Jeff, one of the things that I find when people read my bio at a presentation or something is that it doesn't feel like it encapsulates me very well. And I know you're more than all of your awards. So what's something that's not on your bio that you think the listeners should know to get a better sense of what you're all about?
Something that's not on my bio. I am fluent in Portuguese. I lived in Brazil for a couple of years and I speak fluent Portuguese. And how does that inform who I am? I love language. I love words. And I love the way languages can share a common root and how there are ideas that can be expressed in one language that have no direct translation in another language. I love the way language shapes the way we think and approach the world. So I think that probably says a lot.
Yeah. Great tidbit for an author for sure. Now you're coming to us tonight from Nashville, Tennessee, one of the finest cities in America. Now you didn't grow up in the South, but you love the South more than anyone in the world, except for maybe me. We could fight about that, but you love the South. What do you love so much about the Southeastern U.S.?
I have loved the South ever since I was a little kid. I would see the South depicted on TV. I would see, I would watch Dukes of Hazzard, and I would just know. I just had this intuitive sense. I just knew that was the place where I belonged, and that sense just kept getting stronger and stronger as I got older. When I was in high school, I got really into blues and I taught myself how to play guitar. And that's what I did for a long time. Was I was a guitarist and I played in blues bands and rock bands. And so the music of the South was a huge influence on me. And I've just always known I was supposed to live in this place. I don't know, I don't know what it is about it. There's a sense of myth here and a sort of outlook. Oh, a way of approaching life that I love. I love Southern people. I love the food. I love the music. I love the weather. I'm maybe the only person in the world who likes summer in Tennessee. I just love everything about it. I can't really explain what it is exactly because there was never, a clear point where I fell in love with the South. It's just always been a part of who I am.
Yeah, that's fascinating. I just returned from 3 months in Canada, and while I was up there, sure enough, the weather was incredible, but everyone was saying, wow, I bet you're so glad to be missing, summer in Atlanta. And I said, no, I love running in the summer and, running in August in Atlanta. It's like baptism by fire. It feels like it gets you sweat all the bad stuff out. So I'm with you there, and we're glad to have you be a part of this beautiful place. So you are, among other things, you're a Vandy-educated attorney. You're the best, most talented guitar player I've ever personally met. You're a very talented guy. But the thing that really impressed me about you is that of all the friends that I know who have written books, and I have a couple, you were more intentional about that process than anyone else I've known. And so I wanted to speak with you tonight about the process, your process of bringing something from that blank page all the way through to fulfillment. Now, I read recently that 80% of Americans say that they want to write a book as part of their bucket list. 80% of people want to write a book before they die. What do you think, play psychologist with me, if you will, what do you think is behind that desire to write a book?
So I think human beings, I think a byproduct of our advanced brains is a survival instinct for our spirit, for our memory. We're an animal that has memory. We're an animal that gathers stories, that collects stories. And I think we have just as we have an instinct to protect the organs inside our body, to protect the brain inside our skull, you know, to protect our physical life, I think we have an innate impulse to protect our storytelling life and to protect our memories. And to propagate our memories the same way we propagate ourselves as a species. And so what I think that means is that we as human beings are drawn to those ways that we fix our stories permanently, that we make them permanent, that we pass them along, that we make them part of our heritage. So if you ask me, that's what's behind it. Yeah, I think it's a very elemental urge.
Yeah, that's beautifully put. In just the same way that a skull protects, you know, a skull or a rib cage protects a vital organ, putting something on paper protects and makes sure that that story will continue. That's absolutely beautifully put. So the next question is maybe a bit of a snarky one. Is writing a book right for everyone? Like, do all 80% of those people who want to write a book, should they? Yeah.
So I think every human being has this desire to preserve their spirit, to preserve memories on some level. I don't think writing a book is for everyone. I think doing something to preserve those memories and to preserve that spirit is for everyone. But I don't think writing a book is necessarily for everyone. Simply put, because not everybody likes all the same things. I mean, to me, it's unfathomable that anyone would dislike reading, or that anyone would prefer to do anything but read. Okay, but there are a lot of people who just simply don't love reading. It's boring to them. Maybe they have some sort of reading disability that makes it difficult for them. They just haven't found the right books. Whatever it is, maybe they just don't like reading. And so, if you don't like reading, then writing is not going to be for you, because you have to read good writing to be a good writer. And you have to know how words look on a page to be able to write words. So no, I don't think writing a book is for everybody. Plus, a book is a huge commitment and it requires a ton of patience. It requires an ability to see things through to the bitter end. And that's just not the way everyone is wired, and that's totally fine. There's no judgment in that. There's no, you know, it doesn't make you a better person to be able to finish a book. Some of the worst people I know are people who can successfully finish multiple books. So it's not a qualitative judgment in any way. It's just one of those things. So if it's not the thing that you should be doing, I don't think you should do it.
Yeah. So everyone has this impulse to tell story, to preserve heritage and preserve narrative, but that's going to look different for different people, right?
And just absolutely.
Figuring out what that is for you. No judgment if a book's not your thing. So for the subset of people for whom writing a book is a real desire, for whom reading is a big hobby, what do you think stands in the way of them getting it done? Because certainly nothing like 80% of people are completing a book in their lifetime. So what do you see as one or two of the biggest impediments to achieving that goal?
So I think we have a culture of kind of instant gratification, you know, in our country, in this time we live in. If you don't know the answer to a question, you get on Google and you immediately are gratified with an answer to the question. If you're hungry, you drive to McDonald's and you can immediately gratify that hunger. But there are no shortcuts like that to writing a book. There's no quick way to do it. There's no fast way to do it. There's no instant gratification in it. So I think that's one big thing, is that there's just a cultural thing. Another thing is that it takes a lot of time. And I think people don't necessarily prioritize creative time in their lives. I think they let other things get in the way. I think most people actually do have time to write a book. Now, you may not have time to write a book in the way you think books should be written, which maybe you imagine books being written in a gazebo by a lake, you know, watching the sunlight dapple on the water and smoking a pipe and typing on a typewriter for 5 years until you have the great American novel. Maybe that's what you think writing a book looks like. And if you think that, then it's going to be very easy to persuade yourself that you don't have time. If you think, however, that writing a book looks like taking that 10 minutes that you're using to put away laundry or unload the dishwasher or walk to your bus stop to think about plot and to think about characters and to plan out a story. And when you get on the bus to work, the way I do, that's my writing time, is on the bus to and from my day job, getting out your phone and using that time to write. So there's all of this kind of, you know, like how a Toyota Prius uses otherwise wasted energy from breaking the car. Okay, so when the car breaks, there's this wasted energy, there's this wasted heat energy, and the Prius captures that energy and diverts it back to the battery, right? Mm-hmm. Well, in our lives, we have a lot of just kind of wasted time, time that we're not using efficiently. If you can use that time and harvest that time and put it toward writing in some way. And by the way, I consider thinking about what you're going to write to be writing. I consider that writing. Then I think you can overcome that very common impediment, which is that people don't have time to sit and write books in the way you think of people writing books. The way most people who write books the way you think books are written do it is they have maybe a trust fund. Honestly, a lot of full-time writers are trust funders. Maybe they have a partner who pays the bills for them and takes care of them financially. It's very, very difficult to find that time.
Yeah, it's you know, for me, you've accomplished so much, but for me, the moment when you arrived is when you were featured on a bus advertisement for the city of Nashville, because Jeff did write his book on his phone on the way to and from, you know, to and from the courthouse. So that's absolutely fantastic. And this is a conversation I have with people too, who have said, you know, how do you write so many books? And I say, you know, a page a day every working day of your year, and you've got a book every single year. And I think—
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I think that many people, you know, many people have, you know, an hour a day to write a book that could be, you know, take away a little Netflix time or whatever in your halfway there. So, you know, I'm actually watching a course right now by Judy Blume, right? The young adult author, Judy Blume.
And oh, wow. Yeah.
Yeah. It's really good. And she talks about writing as almost a way of life. And she talks about, you know, sort of the writer's mindset and refers to it in a sort of meditative tone, where every interaction you have, you know, every time you sit down to lunch at the food court, you have a notebook there and you're watching the interactions that go on around you. And it just seems like a mindful way to live. And that really appeals to me. And it speaks to your comment earlier that there are things in your life that are part of writing a book that ostensibly have nothing to do with writing a book, right? It's not you sitting down with the typewriter by the sun-dappled lake. But, you know, that hour at Taco Bell can be rich grist for the mill if you allow it to be.
Yeah, absolutely. Couldn't agree more.
Yeah. So you have written a coming-of-age story set in the rural South. You've written a story about a tragedy that occurs while texting and driving. And your upcoming book, which is fascinating to me, is about a cable access horror show. So what advice do you have on sourcing the seeds of these diverse sort of ideas? Where do you get your germ of an idea from?
So there's a common thread throughout all those books. And it is, in every one of those books, I am writing about people who fascinate me. For me, that is the surest way to be able to finish a book, is if I let characters who are very real to me carry me on their backs through the long deserts of that book. Because novels, you know, they're long. There's a lot of pages there, and there are deserts in your writing. And so if you can ride a character through that desert on their back, let them carry you through those difficult times, then you're more likely to finish. So all of those books have people whose lives I want to inhabit, people who I want to get to know. Also, they have experiences that I want to confront. Now, for example, the best example of this is my second book, where I write about a teenager confronting just an utterly cataclysmic tragedy where his three best friends, basically his entire social group, die in a single car accident that he may have caused. So what I wanted to confront there was to imagine the most dire circumstance I could be in and explore those emotions from the safety of my remove as an author. So to kind of ride out in the field and meet those emotions head on. Because the way I'm wired is, if I'm afraid of something, I have to confront it, right? So if there's a wasp, I hate wasps. If there's a wasp buzzing around inside my shed, I can't just let it be. I have to go in there and confront it and kill it. You know, if I'm standing in a high place, I have to go right to the edge and look over. So I'm just wired to confront the things that I fear. And so that's something I do frequently in my books.
You know, it's fascinating that you say that. I haven't been a shrink. I mean, I haven't been an honest-to-goodness therapist in nearly a decade. And yet I will always say that the time I spent as a clinical psychologist benefited me so deeply, because it just introduced me to a broader swath of humanity than I would have met otherwise. It brought me into close proximity to people and experiences and tragedies, frankly, that I wouldn't have experienced otherwise, and gave me empathy and experience with those things. And it sounds like you're saying that writing is another way to sort of expand the human experience, to get in touch with types of people and types of experiences that you want to have that empathy for, but you might not naturally be proximal to. That's great.
Yeah, exactly. And here's what I liken it to. So think of your personality as being composed of a lot of, you know, various things. You know, you're a curious person, or you have a penchant for fashion, or you like fantasy novels, whatever it may be. So you take that penchant you have and you treat it as a seed, and you put it in other soil to see how it grows up in that other soil, and that other soil are other characters. So it's a way of taking pieces of yourself and living other lives with pieces of yourself.
That's fascinating. Fascinating. So you mentioned a common theme that runs through all three books is this people that you're fascinated by. I've not read the third, but I've read the first two. And I can say, I think without spoiling too much, that death is a theme that runs through the first two books. How do you think that a deeper understanding of life's impermanence can lead to a more fulfilled life?
I think in a couple of ways. First of all, I think if you think a lot about what limited time you have on Earth to accomplish the things you want to accomplish, it acts as a driver and it acts as an engine, and it's going to make you get up and do things. It's going to make you not procrastinate doing the things you want and need to do. The other thing it does for me is it puts things in perspective. You know, maybe I'll have a bad day at work, or I'll just be feeling depressed. You know, I suffer from depression. Maybe I'll just be feeling depressed. And to me, it's very comforting to know that this all ends someday. Like there will come a point where all of these problems just are very petty. They end. There is an end to this race. And after that, you know, who knows what happens? I hope there's an afterlife of some kind, and I hope it's a good afterlife. But, you know, if there's not, what are you worrying about all this stuff for? Do the things that count. Do the things that matter, and don't let the little things get to you.
Yeah. Well, it also speaks to what you said earlier about a rider living different lives. You know, I frequently lament the fact that I sort of have to pick a profession and stick with it, you know, just to make a living. And I say, you know, I can imagine a life where I was a children's author, and I can imagine a life where I'm a film director and a psychologist and, you know, an investment manager and 100 different things. But it sounds like one of the ways that you skirt that is by living multiple lives, living a new life every time you write a book. And I think that's a fantastic thing.
Yeah, my idea of heaven would be just to get to live over and over and over and live. I mean, basically an idea of reincarnation. I'm not super familiar with the concept of reincarnation, but to be able to live life after life, but to maintain some awareness and maintain sort of a core personality, but live life after life, I think would be so wonderful. And books kind of afford you the ability to do that.
Yeah, it's fantastic. So I'm going to rely on you to be my therapist here for a minute. I'll see if I can get a little free counseling like people
sure.
try and get from me. So I've written a couple of books, but I'm trying to get out of my comfort zone a bit. I've written a number of nonfiction books, and now it's very easy for me to write a nonfiction book. It's very comfortable. It's very aligned with what I do at work, and it's all sort of running in the same direction. So I've been working on starting a novel, right? And I'm staring at this blank page, and I'm absolutely intimidated by the vastness, the vastness of it. And I find that when I've written my other books, that an object in motion tends to stay in motion. So how do you overcome the vastness of that first empty page and get started on the journey of writing a book?
Well, here's my trick. I don't start writing a book with the empty page. I start writing a book by first identifying who fascinates me at that point in my life. Then I get to know those people. I invite them into my head. And for months, as long as it takes, I will just let those people that I want to get to know live inside my head and incubate there. And I'll just eavesdrop on their conversations. I'll let them become fully formed people in my head. And once they are such fully formed people that I can be assured that if I let them out of my head, they'll tell me their story and I won't be trying to tell them their story. That's when I first come to the blank page, because then I'm not trying to impose my story on fictional characters, because I don't know how to tell anybody their story. I can't tell you, Dr. Daniel Crosby, your story. I can't do that. What I could do though is listen to you as you tell me your story, and I can write it down and I can embellish on it and I can, you know, add flowery words and phrases. I can do that, but I can't tell you your story. And the same is true of fictional characters. I can't tell fictional characters their story, but I can listen as they tell me their story. So the trick is to get to know those characters so well. And with every human being comes the natural arc of a story. They human beings come as packages of wants and needs and desires and memories and people who love them and they the people they love and all of the things that make a good story, human beings naturally have, right? So if you know a character as a full person, you are going to come to the page already with a set of obstacles that they need to overcome. And overcoming obstacles is at the heart of storytelling. That's, you know, that's why we tell stories. That's why you consume stories, to watch people overcome things and to learn things and to grow in some way and to go on some sort of journey.
So I love that. That's an extremely lyrical way of putting it. I love how you've put that. My question, I guess, is as a psychologist, right? As someone who studies things like confirmation bias, you've written books that in some cases feature young women who are, you know, 20 years younger than you. So how, when you're listening to the story of someone who on the surface has very little in common with you demographically, how do you get inside the head of someone and make sure it's their story and not yours, I guess?
Yeah, you just have to be, I think, ever vigilant for you. Well, first of all, you have to be incredibly observant to how people really are. And you have to be very aware of your own lenses that you wear, your own baggage that you bring to your observation, and make sure that that's not coloring your observation or biasing your observation. So you have to be a very, very keen observer of people. You have to be a really good listener. You have to listen to people as they tell you their experience, and you have to believe them and take them at their word. Because if you don't believe them, then you're going to be inclined to try to impose your experience and your biases on their experience. And that's not going to work, because then you're going to be a 40-year-old guy, you know, writing a teenage girl who inexplicably has all the musical taste of a 40-year-old guy and uses right. all the slang of a 40-year-old guy and loves all the TV shows that a 40-year-old guy loves. If you really observe and listen, then you're going to get past those things.
So I'm commonly asked, you know, when you were a therapist, how did you get people to divulge their innermost secrets to you? How do you get people who you scarcely know to tell you all about their lives? And I would always say, you just ask, you just listen, right? If people understand that you have ears to hear, the whole world is aching to tell their story, as you put so nicely earlier. So it just takes listening, it sounds like, being observant, and opening yourself up to those stories, and they'll readily present themselves to you. Yeah.
Yeah, you got to let a silence breathe, and people will fill the silence, and they'll tell their story to a listening ear. Again, it goes back to what I was saying earlier about that desire to tell your story. If you give people space to do that, they will do it.
So one of the things, I've known you now for a number of years, and one of the things that's been fascinating for me to observe just through your social media channels is the way that your works touch the lives of young people. You know, you write young adult fiction, and it's really neat. You go out and speak at these high schools, and you see kids and young adults who have been really, really impacted by these stories in meaningful ways. When you turn that bright light of introspection in on yourself, what's a book that impacted you? What is a book or an idea that's changed your life?
I think probably The Road by Cormac McCarthy was a very influential book on me in terms of really getting me to think about what do we have when you strip it all away? When you strip away all of the day-to-day worries, when you strip away the jobs and the cities and the electricity and the plumbing and everything that we surround ourselves with, what are we at our core as human beings? What matters? And it is really love and loving other people and you know, the people we want to be with. That was a really huge hugely impactful book on my thinking.
Yeah. I think I read that book in a day. It was it was just one of those that you absolutely could not put down. One thing that I like to do on the podcast, I'm a believer in connectedness, and I know that my world's been made a lot richer by following smart people like yourself. Name someone that you follow on, you know, either on social media or elsewhere, that the listeners will be better off for reading, following, or listening to?
Ta-Nehisi Coates, mm-hmm. I think, is, if not the smartest person in America, one of the smartest people in America. The title of his book escapes me. I have it here somewhere.
Between the World and Me?
Between the World and Me, yep. Mm-hmm. Was hugely... was hugely important to me in terms of thinking about race and thinking about different experiences and understanding why people are the way they are. And he's just such a brilliant thinker. Yeah, you can't go wrong with Ta-Nehisi Coates.
I posed a question on Twitter a few months back that said I had been reading a book on Jean-Paul Sartre and thinking about how he was a public intellectual cum rock star. I mean, he was really, he was, you know, the Kim Kardashian of his day for being an existentialist philosopher. And I was sort of, lamenting the fact that we don't have rock star public intellectuals anymore. And I said, you know, who are the public intellectual rock stars of our day? And Ta-Nehisi Coates was right at the top of that list for most folks. It's a great follow. So just as we close here, I want you to leave listeners with three steps. You know, a lot of, I know that when I present a lot of times or when I listen to a presenter, there's a lot of good theory, but how practically do we get started? And so if you would, what are three steps that listeners can take today to get just a step or two closer to that select group of people who do complete a book in their lifetime?
Okay, so step number one is if you want to write, you got to read. Period. I mean, that is a minimum requirement. You have to read to be able to write. There's no two ways about it. You don't need a creative writing degree, but you do need to read. So if you want to write a nonfiction book, you have to read nonfiction books. If you want to write a novel, you have to read fiction. You have to love fiction, and you have to have a story that you want to tell. So that's the first thing. If you want to write, you have to read. There's just no shortcut there. The second thing, you have to be committed to only allowing criticism to make you better. Okay, so you encounter a lot of different types of criticism as an author. You encounter the very unconstructive criticism of the kind of YouTube comment variety, the one-star Goodreads review, the one-star Amazon review variety, where people just hate your book, they hate your face, they hate your existence, they hate everything about you. There's not much you can do with that. So you have to be committed to letting that roll off your back and not letting that break you. By the same token, it's almost as hard to take the kind of criticism where somebody says, I read your book, you're off to a good start, but you have to be committed to not letting what follows but break you. Whether it be, but I don't think this book is for me, but here are a list of things that you need to improve upon as a writer. You have to be committed. You have to know that that's going to come. You have to know that no writer in the history of humanity has ever gotten it perfect on the first try, who has ever gotten it beyond being given a note, right? So you have to have that commitment in your heart. And the third thing is you have to be able to finish what you start. Nobody wants to read a book that just trails off mid-sentence. You have to be able to finish what you start. You have to commit yourself. If I'm going to start this story, I'm going to finish it. So I'd say those are the three concrete steps that you need. And then there are a lot of other little things. It certainly helps to have friends who will read your writing and give you critiques, all of those sorts of things. But those are, I think, the three most concrete steps you can take.
I read something today that said that Google was the 22nd search engine to hit the market. I'm just making the point that good ideas are plentiful, but good execution is in scarce supply.
That's so, exactly right.
Yeah, lots of people have a great idea for a book, but it's only those who commit themselves to the path that you've just talked about are the ones that get there. And you know, gentle listeners, I contacted Jeff forever ago and said, hey, buddy, I'm ready to write a novel and, you know, help me get started. And Jeff said very gently and very nicely, read 50 novels and call me back, basically. And I haven't called him back yet. So we're still working on the 50 novels because I've read nonfiction my whole career. So it's time for a change if I'm going to do what you said.
Yeah, I think there's a monster novel waiting inside you. I know you've got it in you. You just have to have your reading in place.
Yeah, well, and you know, it's the very fact that it's so difficult for me that makes it so exciting for me, because it's massively hard. But I think that's why writing a book is such a joy, and it's so meaningful when you get it accomplished. Everyone, Jeff, thank you so much. Everyone, please go check out Jeff's books. They're absolutely fantastic. The Serpent King made me bawl my eyes out. I won't lie to you. And so, Jeff, thank you so much for being here and for sharing your insights with our listeners today.
Thank you, Daniel. And let me publicly thank you for all your help with my second book. Your insights were unbelievably valuable, absolutely invaluable to me. That therapist character in my second book is heavily based on Daniel. So let me just publicly say thank you. And it's been an honor to talk with you on your podcast.
Thanks so much, Jeff. And if people want to follow you, where can they get a hold of you and learn more about your work?
So I'm on Twitter and Instagram at Jeff Zentner, JeffZentner. So those are probably the two most active social media outlets for me.
Lots of good writing content and lots of cute dog pics as well. So follow Jeff for all of those things. Thanks again, Jeff.
Hey, thanks, Daniel. I appreciate it.
Bye.
Bye.
All opinions expressed by Dr. Daniel Crosby and podcast guests are solely their own opinions and do not reflect the opinion of the Guardian Life Insurance Company of America, Guardian, and its affiliates, subsidiaries, employees, and agents. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as a basis for legal, tax, and investment decisions. The opinions are based upon information participants consider reliable, and Dr. Crosby and Guardian are not responsible for the consequences of any decisions or actions taken because of the information provided. Guardian trademark and the Guardian G trademark logo are registered service marks and are used with express permission. All materials are subject to United States copyright laws. Copyright 2018 Guardian.